I'm Christopher Lydon with the freelance American friend of Russia, Russian people, Russian culture, Suzanne Massey. I call her the woman who ended the Cold War because of the almost unimaginable persuasive power that she brought to bear on Ronald Reagan. Now 30 years ago, she's just published her memoir. It's called Trust But Verify, Reagan, Russia, and Me. Trust But Verify being the slogan that Suzanne Massey taught to Ronald Reagan and that he kept repeating to Mikhail Gorbachev, who was the last chief of the Soviet Union, when those two leaders conspired to call off the conflict and get rid of their nuclear stockpiles, almost. At the core of it, Suzanne, you convinced an anti-communist zealot in our White House that he could hate communism and love the Russian people in the same day, in the same political career. And he did it. And it worked, despite everything. How did it happen?
Well, it, of course, it's always a little bit complicated, but let me say that one thing is Reagan was, as I found out, really primarily a people person. He's the only politician I ever met, and I met a whole lot of them, who really wanted to know what did the Russian people think, not what did the Soviets think. Now, we had by that time melded Russian and Soviet into a synonym. As one Russian once asked me sadly, why is it always Soviet Sputnik and Russian tank? We had done it, and of course they were very different. The Russians people that I knew, and I knew a lot of them, mostly the Russians called their government them, and they called themselves us. So it was really what we were doing was making it almost as though all the Germans were Nazis. And that is the first thing. I mean, Reagan really was interested in knowing not what did the Kremlin think, but what did the Russians think, and as much as possible about that. Nobody was giving him that, and he was just, I called it my worm's eye view. I'd spent an awful lot of time in the Soviet Union. I had worked there. I'd studied culture and history and written books about it, and I knew so many people. I was very lucky for that, and I was able to give him a much more rounded picture, I think, and to explain to him that they really weren't all marching in lockstep toward a wonderful communist future, but on the contrary, had suffered a great deal from it. And that's the first thing.
Suzanne, can I just say, I've seen you do this. You in your trench coat, swashbuckling through the streets of St. Petersburg, looking and speaking like a native, making incredibly intimate, everyday connections with these folk. What was it you were telling him about them?
Well, many things. The first thing, I think the most important thing, though I didn't realize it at the time, Reagan was a man of great faith, not as we call organized religion, but great faith, and a churchgoer all his life. He did feel he never wore it on his sleeve because he felt that would be ostentatious, and never went to church in Washington, especially after the assassination attempt, because he wrote in his diary, I could be of danger to people in the church, and he didn't want to disrupt things. But that was very important to him, and he always had thought so, and was very worried about the fact of this sort of supposedly, all of them communist and atheists. So I was able to tell him something that, for some reason, none of the academics, none of the specialists, nobody had ever told him. And that was that the Russians were religious and that they had a religion that had lasted 1,000 years, that it was, even though it was persecuted in every way, and in fact had gone through a genocide, if you want, that it was the only non-Marxist-Leninist as anything to be able to exist at all, and a tribute to the fact that it was very strong, and that it really was still alive. And of course, I saw that all the time because I went to church all the time. And of course, one of the things that was the big stereotype here among academia and all the rest was that it was an old religion nobody cared about, and only people who went there were old ladies. And it was completely infiltrated by the KGB. Well, I reminded them that, after all, these were not immortal old ladies from 1917. They were new old ladies who were renewing themselves inexorably, and they were all having their grandchildren baptized. Among them was Gorbachev. So, and even Putin, who has now admitted that he was, because of his granny, he was baptized. So that was going on. And of course, there was again that lack of understanding, complete, about the fact that the Orthodox believer comes to the king, finds the kingdom of God, not through the priest, but through the liturgy. So it doesn't matter if the priest is false, leave him to his maker. It's the liturgy that never changes that counts for them. So I watched it as it grew over the years. Well, today it's enormous. Today, 2/3 of the Russian people call themselves Orthodox. 82% of Russians now believe in God. And that's more than any other country in Europe. Now, doesn't that make you think?
Suzanne, you were onto that revival before it surfaced. There's a lovely line in the book where you told Reagan, listen to the bells in Russia.
Remember, the bells were kind of the language of that country because it's so big. And that's the way in the countryside that people communicated. And one of the first things that the communists did was to destroy all the bells. Destroy the voice of Russia, if you want. And so all the bells were taken down, melted. There's a lovely story I'd be happy to tell you about how some of them came to Harvard, if you want to know it. But in any case, those bells were not allowed to be rung. And I remember very distinctly the first time I actually heard a bell in Moscow. And that was not until way at the end of the 80s. And so I said to Reagan when he went, listen to the bells.
There's another piece of this that most people don't know. I've heard it from Colin Powell, too, though, that Ronald Reagan had a greater fear of nuclear weapons than anybody who's held that office. Colin Powell said anybody he'd ever known in government. And that he had said to you, I want to dismantle those things. They can have peace if they want it. He was flat out for abolition almost from the moment you met him. Spell that out.
I think there are two things that made that happen. One is very well documented, is Ronald Reagan, as a candidate for the presidency, was taken to visit NORAD, our great center, you know, of atomic everything, I guess, weapons. And as usual, Reagan asked very commonsensical questions. First one he asked to the general was, if one missile landed here, what would happen to you? Well, the general said we'd be blown up, of course. Then he asked, how much warning do we have if something's coming at us? And the general said, well, we could let you know where it was going to land about 10 or so minutes before. And Reagan was appalled by this. And this is all very well recorded in books about him, that he kept asking afterwards. He kept saying, well, what good is it if we can't defend ourselves against it? What good is it for us to have spent all these millions of dollars to develop all this when it really cannot protect us in any way? Now, I think that made a huge impression on him. And I think and I know it did. And then later, he really felt, he said it himself quite often, but he said that he always thought it was better to protect people than to avenge them. And one of the things that he did very early in his presidency was to say that we would now eliminate the initials MAD as a description of our policy, mutual assured destruction. It didn't make a whole lot of noise or headlines, but that's what he did. And then remember that the assassination attempt a few months after his inauguration made a tremendous impression on him. He who, after all, was very religious too, he said over and over that he felt that he'd been spared for a reason, and that the rest of his days belonged to God, and that he was going to try, you know, to make a better and make peace, in effect. And yes, he wanted to eliminate those atomic weapons. You cannot imagine the opposition that he felt and that he went through. They thought he was crazy at first. I mean, you could read about how defense establishment, even his own staff, when he ran for office, he wanted to talk about it then, at 1980. Oh, and they said, well, it was all right to talk about reducing atomic weapons, but eliminating them they said, we just smiled. So that begins then, and it goes all the way through his two terms. He was absolutely, and at one point, I did ask him directly. I didn't ask him direct questions very often because I felt that I was not there as a reporter. I was there to give him whatever he wanted from me. So, but finally, I screwed up my courage, and I said, what do you want from the Russians anyway? And he said, I want to get rid of those weapons, every one. And he said it to me not once, but several times. And before Reykjavik, absolutely.
This is very important. It may be the core of your book, it seems to me, is the frustration of Ronald Reagan's intent at Reykjavik. And you say, among other things, that he was badly briefed on Gorbachev, that the CIA misled him in certain key ways, that George Shultz, his Secretary of State, was as upset about it as you were. George Shultz said, I saw again how poor the quality of our intelligence was about the Soviet Union. These are issues of sort of bureaucratic control that abide into this day. But I'd love you to just sort of pick that apart. How does the bureaucracy do it when Ronald Reagan says, no, I want to get rid of all of them?
Well, they close ranks. And remember, there's the Secretary of Defense. There's the whole defense establishment, which I don't talk about the military because that's a different subject. But the bureaucracy has a lot to lose if that happens. Jobs, money, lots of things. And of course, there were some very strong political conservatives there too, but that's not the most important, I think. But they can. And there's the Joint Chiefs, and they can put a lot of pressure on the president not to do something. And they tried. They certainly tried. And they were not happy that they hadn't been included in this meeting, which I think they had a right to be. But the military, quite different, the high military, officers that I happen to know. I remember one general telling me the job of the military is to stay out of war. And if we're in one, to win it. Well, they were far less rattling swords than, but the high bureaucracy in our country was very, very, very against this. Imagine Ronald Reagan had offered to share everything with the Russians so they could not be worried, to have them assist and be able to see all the tests, to share all information with them about what we were doing and how we were developing. And that was, part of the huge offer of Ronald Reagan.
You quote Ronald Reagan saying flat out he was willing to share everything we had in SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative, with the Russians. Did he mean it?
Yes. And of course, at first they didn't believe. And then 1 year after, then he went home. He went home after that. And then they more or less came around to the whole thing. But by that time, he was very weakened by Irangate, very weakened. And the Russians, came around to be sort of believing that he really meant it. Gorbachev, when he proposed it, said, well, you don't even want to share milk machines with us. Something else, I can't remember, but how can we believe that you're going to do this? It would take a revolution, he said, to have it. And revolutions are rare, said he. That's his exact words. So there was this question of trust, which was beginning. It began, but in fact, at the very end, Arbatov said, I think to my, I can't remember, to one of our side, I said this, that unfortunately, there was not enough trust. Well, that's one thing. And then I'll add one more thing that scared the death out of me when I heard it. Raoul Sagdiev, who you may know, was great, great. He married Susan Eisenhower, and he was the advisor of Gorbachev on SDI. And he said that when the Soviet delegation came back from that one of them came to him and said to him, and this just shocked me, that one of the American delegation, of which there were only 12, said to him, thank you for stopping our crazy president.
This was an American to his Soviet counterpart.
To a Soviet, yeah.
You were the woman who gave him that trust but verify line. I'll never forget it. Dovryai, no provryai.
How did that happen? He certainly got it down, and he used to get this look from Gorbachev. Gorbachev would say, "You always say that, Mr. President." And he said, "Well, I believe it," or whatever.
He said, "I like it," is what he said. That was when they signed the first, you know, treaty, the INF treaty. That's what Reagan said. It just happened. I had seen Reagan quite a lot in sort of personal, informal situations. And we were having lunch that day, and it was right before Reykjavik, and I was with just Mrs. Reagan and President Reagan. And at one, and he was talking about how the Soviets negotiate, and you know how difficult that was sometimes. And I said, "Well, you know, Russians often like to express themselves in proverbs, and there's one," I said, "that might come handy in your discussions." I said, "It's dvilyai no proveryai, and it means trust, but verify." Well, I will say both President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan leapt on it. They liked it very much and asked me to write it down right away. And of course, he made it his own. And now it's part of the American lexicon, which I think is charming. And one thing I heard from our former ambassador, which is also charming, is that Gorbachev occasionally would repeat it using Reagan's accent.
Suzanne, go back to the beginning of how you determined to get inside that White House, and then just how it worked that you and Ronald Reagan discovered not only an intense cordiality personally, but you came away admiring his mind, his character, his wife, the whole thing. There you were, a sort of conservative Democrat, but not really a political figure, and you left him with an impression of the Russian people that I think changed our history.
I'm a writer, you know. I'm not a politician, and writers do observe people. And I had a lot of chance because I was told, I didn't know this at the time, but I was told by the Reagan Library after he left the presidency that I had more face time with him on the subject of Russia than anyone but his closest advisors. I didn't know that. So, you know, I'm telling you, I was observing a lot. And I saw many things about this man. One of the things I discovered was that he often played possum. I mean, I think it suited him sometimes to play dumb. He was not dumb. And it suited him to do that because I think he was extremely intuitive about people. In fact, Gorbachev told me directly that he was the most intuitive leader he had ever met. And he said, "That's an actor's talent." And that's true. He was denigrated for being an actor. But on the other hand, actors, if they're good, if they do their profession really well, what do? Their job is to get into the skin of a person very different from them, to understand the motives of a person very different from them. And they don't look for mirror images. And I think Reagan did that very well with Gorbachev. I helped him because we talked a lot about, I met him, had meetings with him before every meeting with Gorbachev. And I tried to explain to him a little more about the Russian character than he knew. And I did know quite a lot about it. And I could explain to him sometimes their more emotional reactions than ours. And we're seeing it today with Putin, my heavens. That is absolutely a raw emotional reaction. Using words like humiliating us and betraying us, that is very emotional. So that once happened. I was told also that a reporter, a European reporter, had asked Gorbachev when he began to really feel that he could work with Reagan, and he said, because when he used a Russian proverb. Now, you see, I think Reagan was not, I know he wasn't stupid. For instance, it was said he never read. Well, he read everything. He read all kinds of things. All the people who worked closely with him said he was always reading. He read all my books, for one thing, and he read everything else. He was a very eclectic reader. And Nancy said that he always read before he went to sleep. So he read. He writes beautifully. Anybody who wants to see that, all they have to do is read the now published letters that he wrote. He wrote 10,000 letters in his lifetime. and he writes them amazingly well. And that's, I think, there's where you see the great communicator. He was always called stupid. He was far from stupid.
Just how hard was it, Suzanne Massey, for a, shall we say, writer, housewife, regular person to get into the Oval Office with the President of the United States and sell him a line that he maybe initially didn't want to even hear? I mean, it sounds impossible.
I had just come from the Soviet Union, where suddenly a very high-level official, when we were talking, suddenly looked at me and said, you don't know how close war is. I did not believe him at first. I thought they always lie, but I couldn't get it out of my head. So now I go to Switzerland, my country, for the birthday party of my cousin, and I'm in bed at night, in the middle of the night, and suddenly I woke up bolt upright. I mean, honestly, like daylight, and something said to me, go home. Not anything else, just go home. And so I knew that I couldn't tell my relatives, I heard my free-thinking relatives, that I heard voices in the night, but I did. I changed my plans, and I started going back. And on the plane, somehow, I kept hearing something that said to me, you've got to talk to President Reagan. No bureaucrats, just President Reagan. I didn't succeed at first, but I knew quite a lot of senators, because a lot of senators had been consulting and asking me about my trips and all that. So I went, you know, I live in Maine. So I went to Senator Bill Cohen, who was our senator from Maine, and who happened also to be on the Armed Forces Committee and quite high there and very involved in arms control. And so, of course, I went to see him. And it turned out that he was, well, anxious to talk about his novels and poetry and his trip to Russia and all that. And finally, he said, you know, you ought to see Bud McFarlane. And I knew that Bud was newly named National Security. And so really, it was as simple as this. Bill picked up the phone in my presence and said, hello, Bud. I got this woman here who knows a lot about Russia. Maybe you should see her. And, well, Bud agreed and said to give me 20 minutes. And that's how I met Bud McFarlane. Well, that got me into the White House. I got my little remarks down to 20 minutes and told him about, you know, the atmosphere I'd seen there when I had just come back. And I said, look, to me, they looked extremely nervous, which they were. And that I thought perhaps they might be amenable to talking again about a cultural exchange. He said from that 20 minutes that I had gotten down to the second, he didn't get up. He said, what you have to say is so interesting. Can you come back and talk for 2 hours? I did. And then he said he'd shown it to the president. The president was interested. And I, you know, at one point I just raised my hand and said, why don't you send me? I can talk to them. Well, they did. And at that point, I didn't know how absolutely, unbelievably bad our relations were. For the first time, at the beginning of 84, we had no relations with the Soviet Union at all, period, for the first time in 14 years. It was as bad, historians now say it was the most dangerous period in the whole Cold War. And I'm going over there suggesting that I can talk to them about the cultural exchange. Well, they did send me. I did, and they did say they would. And that was wonderful. And they started discussions about that. And in the end, it was the only pact that Reagan and Gorbachev signed in Geneva in 1985. I was very proud of that, I have to tell you.
Suzanne, when did you know that somehow you'd gotten Ronald Reagan's full attention, hearing aid and all, that he was getting it?
I never knew. I really never knew. It was only when I saw what actions came that I realized what he had internalized and how he'd internalized. He really did internalize things very well and then know how to use them in his own inimitable way. That was certainly true for the trip that he made to Moscow, where he knocked out the Russians. When he left, the Russians said that they believed he could probably, that he had more supporters in the Soviet Union than he had in the United States.
Suzanne, then and now, it strikes me that some of this sort of built-in hostility, distrust, pessimism comes through the media, too. our media, I mean, which didn't really grasp Gorbachev or Reagan or that moment. And even now, 2014, I wonder, is it misreading the Crimea and Ukraine and President Putin?
I gave a lecture yesterday at the University of Maine. That lecture is entitled, Why Are We Always Wrong About Russia? We are and have been since the revolution. And I start with a Russian proverb, which says, ignore history, you lose an eye. Forget history, you lose two eyes. And that is what our press didn't seem to have a simple clue about history, let alone our policymakers, who simply went, you know, right in there without realizing that, you know, how sensitive, what a raw nerve this was. I will say Kissinger said it very well. He said, demonizing Putin is not a policy. It's an alibi for a policy. I don't know why that terrible campaign of denigration, and that started almost right after, you know, the end of the Cold War for the last 10 years, but got worse and worse and worse. I know the Russians have been very upset about it because they didn't know what to do about it. And so every single thing they did was, you know, run down or being unsuccessful or being bad or, you know, corruption, I don't know what, but never anything good and never really looking at anything that had been accomplished, let alone this extraordinary return of the Russians to religion, which is, I think, historically very important. There is just so much in history that helps us to understand something that's going on. And I wish that our first reactions and our first in this particular crisis had been informed a little bit more by history. So now what can we do? All the things that was built up carefully, I will say, by Reagan and Gorbachev, the beginning of what was trust. I mean, Reagan was able to do something no one had done before with a communist leader. He was able to establish a relationship of trust, if not agreement. But you can't do anything unless you trust. And they don't trust us at all anymore. And I have a feeling, my own opinion is they have reasons not to trust us.
Suzanne Massey, thank you so much. Be prepared to go and knock on the White House door again for all of us.
Thank you, Chris. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you.